You are listening to WXRW LP Milwaukee 104.1 FM, RiverWestRadio.com globally, or CreamCityMedia.com/anti. Hello again, I am your host, NTSC, and welcome to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti's anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, anti-electoralist, that's a tough one, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we try to explore what a free society could look like while recognizing that sadly none of us today are truly free. As always, WXRW River West Radio needs help. Times are tough for nonprofits, and especially nonprofits like us who seek to engage, educate, advocate, and activate the young and the disenfranchised. If you want to help us out, go to riverwestradio.com. You can donate directly to the station. You can visit us at 824 East Center Street and get yourself some gear that I highly recommend you use. You can reach out and become an official underwriter. Become a community partner with us, and in so doing, we will support you. So, last week, we covered slacktivism, which also goes by a different name, sabotage. Who uses that term historically? Well, we will get into that in the main part of this week's episode. But first, as is often sadly the case in my 29-minute format, I kind of had to rush last week and I didn't get a chance to finish a few thoughts about slacktivism in the workplace that I had and wanted to communicate. So first, we'll get those thoughts out of the way and then we will dive into this week's episode proper. So one of the tools in the slacktivist's tool belt, as it were, is to do as little work as possible, right? Or to work inefficiently. By doing the least possible work required to remain employed, you will also be helping your fellow workers. You can make life easier for all of the people around you simply by lowering the standards of work significantly. Remember, you know, for example, if you work too hard, suddenly the expectations of your managers and your bosses change. And then everyone needs to suddenly keep pace with that new normal. Once your boss or your employer or, you know, managers see that a certain amount of production can, you know, is physically capable of taking place within a shorter time frame than they may have expected, you know, or seen in the past, you can absolutely guarantee that that smaller time frame will become their new expected operating procedure. And they'll just keep moving that bar higher and higher, as has been seen in fulfillment centers and warehouses, especially of the type of, for example, an Amazon fulfillment center and warehouse or an XPO fulfillment center and warehouse. And we'll talk more about dangerous companies like that and the horrible working conditions. We've talked a little bit about the Amazon kind of experience in the past, but suffice it to say, if you can help kind of keep expectations low for the amount of production that can actually be achieved physically in a typical work day, you'll be helping yourself and you'll be helping your fellow workers. Don't give the bosses or the owning class more labor value than they have actually paid you for. Because remember, even that amount to which they have capitulated is far, far too little and mathematically cannot be equal to the labor value you're actually producing. It also, it can be very empowering to remember that your employer is essentially renting you by the hour. You are selling your labor time for wages, but since you don't probably get paid out at the end of every single shift, until you have received your check, they owe you. You don't owe them jack. Okay. Those were my closing thoughts from last week's episode that I didn't get a chance to voice. So if you recall from the episode on isolation, I was feeling pretty down and alone a few weeks ago. Well, in last week's episode, I said that I had some irons in the fire to hopefully work towards ending those feelings of isolation and atomization. To mix some metaphors, those irons have come home to roost. Yes, friends, you are listening to a proud, card-carrying, dues-paying member in good standing of the IWW, or the International Workers of the World Union. I am a newly minted wobbly, and I absolutely couldn't be happier about it. Since I just got my red card in the mail last week, I haven't yet had a chance to stop by my local chapter and begin working and learning how to organize and participating in the cause. But having received some of the materials about the union, I can say I am really honestly very, very excited. So today, for this week's episode, we're going to take a page from the IWW. Quite literally, and just share some of the thoughts and the practices of the IWW. And hopefully, you know, if you don't know much about the one big union, then maybe you'll learn something. And I think that you will see why their methods and beliefs appeal to me personally so much. First, I think it's important to note that none of what I read here today is confidential information printed, you know, of the IWW or by the IWW. It's all available in a pamphlet that they freely distribute called One Big Union. Also, I will disclose that neither I, NTSC, nor River West Radio receive any compensation for the from the IWW or any delegates or representatives thereof. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to get them as an official underwriter, but I don't think that that's going to happen for lots of reasons, and they're, you know, important reasons. But anyway, with all that understood, here we go. I probably won't have time to read the entirety of this pamphlet, so I'm going to read the preamble first to make sure that I get to it, because this is probably my favorite part of the whole presentation. This is the preamble to the Constitution of the Industrial Workers of the World. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed, and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members, in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, "A fair day's wage for a fair day's work," we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, "Abolition of the wage system." It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for the everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. I just love that. That's just great. That just gets my nerves all tingling in happy ways. Okay, so with the remainder that we have here, about 19 minutes or so from the looks of it, we're going to read as much as we can from this pamphlet and you know, maybe talk about what we get to. And perhaps next week we'll finish it. We'll see what happens in the interim. But here we go. One big union. Our place in human progress. What is industry and how did it develop? Industry. From converting raw materials into the things people want to providing services people need is the center and foundation of our social life. The capitalists who own and control the natural resources and the equipment and facilities necessary to transform raw materials and to provide these services form the much smaller of the two classes in society. The workers who gather raw materials, transform materials into usable goods, and provide services society needs are the other and much larger class. The interests of these two classes are opposed. This fact shapes the entire social life of the world. The business or capitalist class is eager to stay in control and keep the privileges that come from having that power. To make that control secure, it seeks to gain or keep control of all social institutions. It wants to write and administer the laws. It wants the schools to teach respect and obedience to the privileged few. It wants the press, television, and internet to shape our thoughts and feelings to serve its interests. And where it cannot get rid of the organizations that labor has built, it wants to control them too. Two outstanding facts threaten the capitalists' control. One, modern industrial development has made their activities unnecessary. And two, the working class is able, once it so desires, to take control of industry and thus establish a much more efficient and satisfactory society. The original function of the capitalist was to provide funds and management. Today, management is the job of specially trained managers, and funds are amply provided out of the various reserves taken from profits. The system of corporate administration that the capitalists have built up has made them unnecessary. The capitalist class came to power as the result of long struggles against kings and feudal landowners. Kings and feudal landowners ran the world based on an agricultural social system where the ownership of land was the basis of power. With the help of the common people who did the fighting, capitalists won the fight against feudalism because new inventions, procedures, and discoveries had made feudalism outdated. The parliamentary bodies that had been created to raise funds for the feudal order had also established a more efficient system of government and had made the kings and lords as obsolete as the capitalists are today. Historic voyages and discoveries, improvements in navigation, and the new factory system had all made the ownership of warehouses, ships, and equipment more important than the ownership of land. The basis of society had shifted from the farm to the factory, and the control of society had shifted to those who control industry. Revolutionary progress. The conservatives of feudal times warned that the advance of capitalism would be the end of civilization. They were wrong, and for all its flaws, capitalism was a step forward. Whatever of the old order was serviceable to the new was kept and cultivated. What was destroyed was aspects of feudalism's rule that obstructed progress. Under capitalism, invention and industry flourished as never before. Our ways of producing and living had changed faster in the last 200 years than in the previous 2000. Each worker's capacity to produce is at least 100 times what it was when capitalism first took over from feudalism. However, because our standard of living has not kept pace with invention and cannot keep pace with it as long as capitalists control industry, the possibilities of abundance and leisure are wasted in artificially created shortages, depressions, and wars. Modern economic development has not only made the activities of the few who control industry unnecessary, it has also reduced the number of people in the capitalist class. The growth of large corporations requires either the closing of a large number of little businesses or their absorption as subsidiaries of larger corporate conglomerates. At the apex of this economic pyramid sit the few, the wealthy, and the powerful. They are an oligarchy who exercise nearly unaccountable authority over the economic functioning of the world and pursue that private interest at the expense of the vast majority of humanity, and often at the expense of the very ecological vitality of the earth which sustains us all. In the face of little organized resistance, capitalists' greed knows few limits. In the United States, recent statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau show that one-fifth of the population receives nearly half of all aggregate income generated each year. Between 1989 and 1996, the wealthiest 5% of the population in the United States experienced a 10% rise in annual income, while 80% of the population lost ground. The rich have gotten richer while working people's incomes have stagnated or declined. In countries other than the United States, the controlling clique is often a considerably smaller proportion of the population. Capitalists of every country coordinate their activities to extract the greatest profit from the labor of working people everywhere. Through cartels and multinational corporations, a handful of people plan and control the economic life of the entire world. According to the United Nations Human Development Report in 1999, the world's 200 richest people more than doubled their net worth between 1994 and 1998 to more than $1 trillion. That was more than the combined income of 41% of the world's people. In 1999, the assets of the top 3 billionaires were more than the combined gross national product of all the least developed nations and their 600 million people. Nearly 1.3 billion people live on less than a dollar a day, and close to 1 billion cannot meet their daily consumption requirements. The handful of people who control the world's resources have many servants, but few friends. Only these few would have their privileges decreased if the control of industry were taken out of their hands. The rest of us would be much better off. Who should control? Since the rise of capitalism, the working class has grown in many ways. It has grown in numbers until it includes almost everybody. It has grown in knowledge and ability. The worker of today has to understand and be able to do things that would have baffled the engineer and scientist of a century ago. In place of a class of illiterate serfs, we are a working class able to read and write. We have an extensive literature of our own. We discuss the news of the world daily. We have also grown in organized power. Every step of the working class has taken in building unity and solidarity, has been a trespass on what was previously the complete exclusive control of owners of industry. Whenever workers fought to reduce the hours we would work, to increase the pay we would take, or improve the safety and sanitary conditions on the job, we had to unite and fight to win. Organized working class movements have been fought by the capitalist class as its mortal enemy, and by the logic of events, that is precisely what organized labor should be. Every step forward that we take strengthens our position as the logical successor of the capitalist class to exercise control of industry. And because there is no class beneath us, our triumph will mean the first classless society since civilization began, and the end of all the horror, cruelty, stupidity, and injustice that necessarily go with class society. The big question for today and tomorrow is this: how is industry to be controlled? It's not so much a question of who is to own industry. Managerial control is what counts, and it has largely become independent of the actual investors. Who is to say whether industry is to run or stand idle? Who is to say what is to be produced and where that product is to go? Who is to decide what services are provided and to whom? These are the important questions. Should modern industry be controlled by a handful of business managers? Should it be administered by politicians? Or should it be run by those who do the work? It must be one of the three. The corporate managers, through their banks, their control over directorships, and their enormous influence over public debate. through the media that they own, seek to ensure their complete control over the economic life of the world, for it does not pay to let the working class produce all that it is capable of producing. So either those in control of industry ally themselves with those in control of government to save themselves from democracy, or those in control of government extend their regulation over industry and its workers, as in the state-controlled economies. Industrial democracy wanted. The industrial workers of the world see nothing good in an economy that is controlled by corporate managers or by politicians. Instead, they want industrial democracy, industry won by its workers through direct democratic processes free from hierarchy. The greatest problem facing humankind is not the much discussed question of production and distribution. It is the problem of power. It never has been and it never will be safe to let a few control the affairs of the many. The depressions, the wars, and the other ills of the modern world have been possible only because there was already an unsafe concentration of power in the hands of the few. What happened was the result of the will of these few, not the will of the many. Under capitalism, every invention that has increased our power to produce or destroy has increased the power of the few and decreased the power of the rest of us. Every improvement in communication has extended the empire of this minority, and every time we give more power to someone to try and remedy the resulting evils, we increase the problem that much further. This holds true whether we allow that power to fall to the present managers of industry, their friends in government, or their friends in the undemocratic business unions. Consequently, the only safe and logical choice is industrial democracy. Industry run by those who do the work, using democratic procedures on a daily basis for the equal benefit of all. It's up to us. We can run industry and thereby solve the problem of power, for all the power that runs this world comes from our own efforts. Our class has only to stop doing what it is told to do and start doing what it collectively decides to do, to deprive its opposition of all the power they ever had and to acquire for itself all the power it will ever need. Management of industry by workers organized to do the job is not a mere dream. It is the historic trend. It is the pole toward which every forward move of labor has pointed, whether intended that way or not, but it cannot be achieved without deliberately planning and organizing for it. If that job is not done, the counter trend wins out. Regimentation of everything, either by all kinds of business, by all kinds of government, or by their unholy alliance, fascism. Industrial democracy is the answer to many problems. It can keep alive the democracy that cannot survive when practiced only on election day. It can free us from want and fear, waste and war. With modern production methods, it can enable ordinary people to get all the material goods they can use by working about as much as they want to. It can give us security and freedom, those two most desirable ends, neither of which is possible without the other. For a person driven by want cannot be free, and the puppet is never secure. It can make organized society a harmonious whole, intelligently working for the good of all. For it is only when all of humankind can decide what is to be produced and what is to become of the product that it can know what it is doing. Industrial democracy can be built only by an organized working class that is aware, as a class, of what it wants and how to get it, rather than giving decision-making power to, quote-unquote, friends of labor in political parties or to controlling cliques and vanguards within its own ranks. Working class organization must serve two purposes. It must provide the most efficient structure for carrying on our daily struggle for better conditions and better pay, and it must provide a comprehensive and flexible solution to the issues regarding the production and distribution of goods in an equitable and ecologically sustainable manner by making possible the efficient management of modern industry by organized labor. Fortunately, but not by coincidence, the same type of organization best serves both purposes. For by organizing the way we work, so that we have the same relations in our unions as we have in the process of production, we are lined up to have the most strategic advantage in our everyday struggle and the necessary coordination for assuming the responsibility for industrial production. How to organize right is thus the immediate question. It is with that question that we are concerned. In organizing, the IWW looks toward the future we want because how we organize will define what the future will be. Okay, with the time that we have left, as I look at the remaining pages, I don't think we're going to get to finish the booklet today, which is fine. We'll take this opportunity to talk a little bit about why this message really jives with me and why that shouldn't come as any big surprise to regular listeners of this show. So if you are researching the IWW, you'll inevitably find their website, and on it is a specific section addressing the question, is the IWW an anarchist or narco-syndicalist organization? And I love that there had to be a whole section on that question right on the primary website. And it's a question that really makes a lot of sense. A lot of very visible anarchists historically have been members of the IWW over its 113 plus years of history. And you can see why the IWW is opposed to capitalism. It recognizes the capitalist owner class as the direct enemy of the worker and, in a sense, of the whole world. It specifically and loudly seeks the abolition of the wage system. Those pillars line up very well with a lot of anarchist beliefs. The IWW clearly states it is against hierarchy, which is arguably the most important and, base pillar of all anarchist thought. The IWW utilizes direct action. All of these things can be seen as anarchist tendencies. The IWW makes it clear that it is not a strictly anarchist organization. Per their own bylaws, to the end of promoting industrial unity and of securing necessary discipline within the organization, the IWW refuses all alliances, direct or indirect, with any political parties or anti-political parties and sects, and disclaims responsibility for any individual opinion or act which may be at variance with the purposes herein expressed. And that makes great sense. Any attempt to gatekeep admission to the one big union, based on politics or religion or race or, any kind of belief system, would be to undermine the very mission of the IWW. The only people who are not allowed in are capitalists, employers, police, correctional officers, and their ilk. Basically the enemies of the working class and the world. There's a lot more to be said on this topic, but I don't think we have time. Thank you so much for tuning into The Anti again here on WXRW River West Radio. I've been your host, NTSC, and I'll be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. We've got a brand new RSS feed. And if you'd like to know more, further information is available about the industrial workers of the world at www.iww.org. See you next week.